We were working on real issues. You know, we weren't talking about fancy ideas. Some of us were reading books, some of us were writing books. All of us were in the street.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
Good evening, everyone. I'm so glad that we could be together, although it's virtually. And as you know, this is our time to celebrate the anniversaries of two books that I'm connected to. One is Homegirls, a Black Feminist Anthology, which was published 40 years ago, this fall originally. And thanks to Rutgers University Press, the publisher of the second edition of Homegirls, last Friday was released the third edition of Homegirls, which is the 40th anniversary edition. And the other book, or as I call them, my book babies, the other book baby that has an anniversary is The Truth That Never Hurts, Writings on Race, Gender, and Freedom. And it is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. It also came out in the fall of 1998, which was just great. The fact that we were focusing on doing the 40th anniversary edition of Homegirls, and because Rutgers publishes both of those books, they wanted to bring them out together, but it would have been really kind of off if it had been the 23rd or the 26th anniversary. So, you know, it was providential. But anyway, that's why we're here. Thanks so much to all of you for being with us. I assume we have people from around the nation, and we're going to get started. But before I say another word, I want to thank Haymarket Books for making this a Haymarket Books live event, because I was telling people how special this was. I said, they're doing a Haymarket live and they didn't even publish the book. So that's really special. And working with everyone at Haymarket has been a joy and a pleasure. I love the cooperation. And then, of course, I want to thank my publisher, Rutgers University Press, who brought these books out. We brought them out very quickly. We did not have much lead time on this, but we managed to do it with great cooperation. And I particularly want to thank my editor, the person who was I was working with, whose exact position at Rutgers. All I can say is that she's one of the people who runs the press, and that's Kimberly Ajunta. So I really appreciate everyone. And what I'd like to do now is I'd like to have my wonderful co-conspirators introduce themselves, and you can go in any order that you wish.
Sure, no problem at all. First of all, Barbara, thank you so much for inviting us to be part of this conversation. This is really exciting, exciting anniversary and all of that. But my name is Haley Pessin. I am a Queens-based socialist, writer, activist, lots of different hats. I go by she, they pronouns. I recently had the privilege of working with Anthony Arnov, who's also part of Haymarket Books, to publish a collected work in the tradition of Howard Zinn called Voices of a People's History of the United States in the 21st Century, Documents of Hope and Resistance. And so that's kind of me. Maybe Tamika, you want to go?
Sure. Good evening, everyone. I am so honored to be here. Always a pleasure to be in space with Barbara. And so lovely to be with the rest of the panelists as well in Haymarket Books and Rutgers. My name is Tamika Middleton. I use she, her pronouns. I am a Southern born and bred organizer. I am the managing director at Women's March, where I get to work with a wonderful team of folks to think about what it looks like to coalesce and cohere the feminist movement in the U.S. in this time. I'm also a mama and a writer and a birth worker and a slew of things that I hope to bring, you know, into this conversation and that then inform how I move and how I do politics in this time. So I will stop there.
What I'm going to do now, and that'll give us a little time to do the troubleshooting. I'm going to read a few paragraphs from my book, Homegirls, A Black Feminist Anthology. And this is from the introduction to Homegirls that was written originally. The introduction was written in 1983. So keep in mind, there's nothing much in it that would say, oh boy, that person was really thinking ahead, because it's about how I grew up and where I grew up. But I did write it 40 years ago. And as I said, this is from the introduction, the original introduction of Homegirls. And this introduction has sections. And this first section is called Sources, as in Sources for Black Feminism. And this is the very beginning of the introduction to Homegirls. There is nothing more important to me than home. The first house we lived in was in the rear. Hidden between other houses, it had a dirt yard that my twin sister Beverly and I loved to dig in, and a handful of flowers my grandmother had planted. We lived there with our mother and grandmother and with one of our great aunts named Phoebe, whom we called Auntie. We seldom saw Auntie because she was a live-in cook for rich people. The house, however, was considered to be hers, not because she owned it, but because Auntie was the one who had originally rented it. She had been the first of the family to come north in the late 1920s, followed by the rest of her sisters and their children, all during the 30s and 40s. The house was old and small, but I didn't know it then. It had two bedrooms. The big one was Auntie's, though she only used it on her occasional visits home. She did domestic work and lived in, so she only used it when she came to visit her own home. The small one, the other bedroom, was where my grandmother, my sister Beverly, and I slept, our cribs and her bed crowding together. Our mother, who worked full-time, slept downstairs on a day bed, which she folded in half each morning, covered with a faded maroon throw, and pushed back against the wall. The kitchen, where we ate every meal except Sunday dinner, was the room Bev and I liked best. Our grandmother did most of the cooking. Unlike her sister Phoebe, she was a plain cook, but she did make a few dishes, little pancakes with alaga syrup and bacon, vanilla-y boiled custards, which appealed even to Bev and my notoriously fussy appetites. The women in my family and their friends work harder than any people I have known before or since. And despite their objective circumstances, they believed. My grandmother believed in Jesus and in sin, not necessarily in that order. My mother believed in education and in books. My Aunt LaRue believed in beauty and in books as well. And their arguments aside, they believed in each other. They also seemed to believe that Beverly and I could have a future beyond theirs, although there was little enough indication in the 40s and 50s that Negro girls would ever have a place to stand. Family's really important to me. I think it's important to most of us. There are a lot of things happening in the world right now internationally where the preciousness of family is at the forefront of our consciousness. And everything I've done, including having books that have 40th anniversary and 25th anniversary editions, everything I've ever done is because of that family that I described. The alternate title is The Black Feminist Nutcase, who is Barbara Smith. So just so you know. And a lot of people who are on this in this gathering with us, this is the first time they've ever heard that I have official biographers. So calm down. And just another thing, just so you know, this is called an intellectual biography. So there's no kiss and tell. There will be no kiss and tell in this. But maybe I'm not telling the truth about that. So you're going to have to read the book and see. Okay? But I'm so happy to be that Jamie is, first of all, that you're able to hear Jamie. And then also that that Jamie is one of my two biographers. I actually have two biographers who are working together on the same book. The other one is Joseph Fitzgerald, who wrote the wonderful book, The Struggle is Eternal, about the wonderful radical civil rights activist, Gloria Richardson. I digress. So we're going to get into Black feminism now, and we're going to talk about where we are, with these 40th anniversary editions. We had a question that we were going to examine to begin with, which was, how did I feel about the 40th anniversary editions, edition of Homegirls, and the 25th edition, anniversary edition of The Truth That Never Hurts? But I said, that's a question for all of us. So I actually would like to hear one of you talk about, like, what these books have meant to you, particularly Homegirls, which is older and I think better known. And just any thoughts you have about the books coming to this point in their lives and in their existence.
You want to go first? Sorry, we're competing for time.
Go for it.
Oh, thank you. So I almost feel a little embarrassed by how late in my political life I found Homegirls, because I, I think of myself, I was a red diaper baby. I had parents who were very political, who were teacher activists. I'm the daughter of one immigrant and, Jewish Black family. So there's a lot of different sort of things that have informed my pathway to an understanding of the importance of Black feminism and of queer Black feminism and a number of other things. So, but I encountered this a little bit late in life, and I think somewhat coming from a tradition that didn't always know quite how to square the difference between our kind of broader understanding that the working class would be an agent of political change and our personal identities and how that comes into play in those struggles. And so it was so kind of refreshing when I did find, there are all of these, Black, queer, and specifically socialist feminists that I had not really encountered in my political life until, again, much later, who saw these things as very integrated. And so that is one of the places where I found a lot of meaning and importance in that book. And then it's also like 40 years. It's interesting. It's like, I'm 32. So like 40 years can sound big to me, or it can sound kind of like not that long ago, actually. And I'm so curious as this conversation goes on to hear what people think about, what has changed and hasn't from the from sort of the inception, not of Black feminism in general, because we know that's existed as long as Black women and femmes have been in this country, but more as a more consecrated discipline, certainly in the academy and as a stream of thought. It's almost young in a certain way. And I think that's an interesting thing, how that still feels incredibly relevant and dynamic and means that we're when we speak about it, we're talking about something we're adding to as well.
All right, thank you so much. I love the idea that you're younger than this book.
No, I thought that was it was so funny to me as you were saying that, because I am approaching my 40th birthday in a couple of weeks. And so I'm like, oh, no, you're like, if 40 can be big, I'm like, wait. but yeah, I mean, I think very, you know, positioned very differently than you, Haley, that coming from a family that was not a political, you know, family, coming from the rural South, the South Carolina Sea Islands, and really finding Black feminism through abolition, through prison industrial complex abolition, abolitionist organizing in the South in the early 2000s, and having that those folks really, excuse me, shape me and introduce me to the text, and actually really introduce me to the text in parts and not really as a whole, like the Coalition Politics article, the Columbia River Collective statement, like those pieces of the text being brought to me as a part of my political education, my political development over time, over many years, and being a reference and something that we can come back to as we're thinking about how we do our organizing work, being able to go back and refer. I know at Women's March, we just went back and reread the Bernice Johnson Reagan, the Coalition Politics. We read that just like a year ago together as a staff. We're like, okay, we're in this coalition work and it is hard. Let's talk about it. and so the text remains so relevant and so tangible as we are trying to think about how it is we continue to make change, we continue to ground ourselves in a feminist politic, in a Black feminist politic, and how we organize, not just in a Black feminist ideology, but how we practice Black feminist in our Black feminism in our organizing. And so for me, it continues to be something, a touch point that we can pull something out and say, here is something, oh, this is something that you're grappling with in your organizing work. Hey, we still have this, you know, this guidance for you and this guidance for all of us as we think about how to shape our work and how to build our strategies and how to make change in real tangible ways for Black women, Black communities. And so the reality that these books remain so relevant is really just a testament to the sharpness of the analysis and the real clarity of the understanding of what it means to organize and what it means to make change for in our communities. And so that's what is up for me when I think about these anniversaries. It's like, we still go back to the text. Like, you cannot, the number of times I see the Columbia River Collective Statement, you know, referred to in life, in work, in, you know, in different spaces as we're reading different texts, you know, as we're training up new Black leaders, new Black left folks, you know, we are constantly going back and pulling from these texts and pulling from this analysis to make sure that our folks are grounded politically, historically, strategically.
Thank you so much for that. I'm going to throw it to Jamie. As people know who are with us for this wonderful evening, we are having technical issues, specifically Jamie, as I understand it, not being seen and not being heard. That sounds like a plot, doesn't it? But be that as it may, I don't like the idea of like reading the chat as opposed to looking at, you know, you, all of you. So like I kind of glance over there and I'm not exactly sure where we are, but I'll just ask Jamie, do you want to try to communicate with us and see where that is? We're talking about what the 40th anniversary and the 25th anniversary of these books mean to us.
Yes. Can y'all, I hope folks can hear me. I got the okay from John from the Haymarket team that folks can hear me, but I want to say that when I think about Homegirls and the truth that never hurts, I think about how I was younger and knew something was wrong, but didn't necessarily have the language to place my rage, my anger, or even my political analysis. And then when I read these like classics, it really like was like, wow, I'm not alone. People, Black feminists have been grappling with these questions for years. this matrix of oppression, these intersectional discussions, right, about identity, leadership, sexism, patriarchy, queer phobia, transphobia. And it's just so wonderful to even think about 40 years later, 25 years later, how these texts stand the test of time. And that's what makes them, as you said before, Ms. Barbara, in our interview together, that's what makes something a classic. And so I'm always going back, because I think that as we are in 2023, and that we have all the digital publics and social media and all these varying definitions of what Black feminism is, or and is not, because it's been distorted often, we can go back to Homegirls and The Truth That Never Hurts and say, this is what a Black feminist, radical leftist Black feminist politic is, right? This is what they meant by all these different terms. And it gives me hope, and it gives me pride in knowing that as a Black feminist that I'm on the right side of history, because you've laid down the history, the blueprint, the foundation for us. So I thank you, Ms. Barbara. I'm learning something each and every single day as I've read these texts over and over again, but I can always learn something new. And that's the beauty about a Black feminist on behavior. It's that it's ever-growing, ever-changing, but also we have to go back to the foundation, right? So I thank you for just all your offerings. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's so wonderful to hear all of your perspectives about this, particularly Jamie, since we didn't know he was going to be X'd out of the whole situation because of something called technology. But so gratifying to hear all of the things that you had to say. And particularly that thing of the longevity of the books. Many people don't know exactly what it is. They know I probably went to college somewhere and, you know, probably did graduate work somewhere, but they're not quite sure necessarily what field I was studying, because I'm so known for doing political organizing and political work. They might think that I went to grad school or whatever in sociology or in political science. No, I went to a graduate school in English, because that's what they called it back then. They didn't call it literature. They didn't call it comparative literature. They didn't call it narratives. It was just English. In other words, what people from certain parts of Europe and then in America, North America, the language that they spoke. And when I went to graduate school, there was no Black studies. I went to graduate school knowing that what I wanted to do was to teach African-American literature. I was preparing consciously to teach African-American literature, but the situation was, for all of the people of my generation, by and large, we could not take courses in the subject matter. So what were we reading? Wordsworth, Shakespeare, Faulkner, Melville. Melville is my favorite, so I'm not going to badmouth him. I'm not going to throw any shade at Melville. But the thing is that we were reading the great white male authors, not women's authors, women writers. We were reading the great white male authors of the United Kingdom and of the United States. That was it. But there's no knowledge that's wasted, particularly if you take it seriously, even though it could be incredibly painful to read some of these authors who were misogynist, who were racist, elitist, you name it, you know, homophobia, yes. Although there was no such term as homophobia then, but certainly you could find it in, you know, in these so-called classic works. You could also find interesting queer themes, and even in plays by someone called Shakespeare. But be that as it may, if you study this stuff deeply enough, you might get something out of it. The reason I'm talking about this is because we're talking this evening, although more probably about politics and literature or writing, we are talking about writing. And one of the reasons that the books, particularly Homegirls, because it's the older of the books, one of the reasons that it has stood the test of time is because the writing is strong. No throwaway pieces in the book. It's an anthology, many, many voices. But I've worked with authors, generally the authors who are in the book, in Homegirls, they were really good writers. I did not make them good writers. I don't know if I helped them to be good writers, but the thing is, in some cases, as an editor, I was asking questions about, like, why don't we do it this way? Why don't we put this there? What do you mean when you said that? You know, those kinds of questions. My grounding in literature is why Homegirls and the Truth That Never Hurts are having these anniversaries, because I can pick out writing that sings, writing that works. I can pick it out of a crowd just like that. And that's my background, you know. I was reading a poem just the other day. I said, damn, this person can really write, you know, because poetry is really hard to write. People, most people don't know how hard it is to write a poem. But poetry, now I'm nerding out here, poetry is considered to be the highest literary form because it's the hardest to master. Short, it has meter, generally. Sometimes it has rhyme. It doesn't have to have rhyme. But there's a thing called a poetic idea. And so if your poem captures a poetic idea using metaphors, similes, description, all kinds of things, that at the end of the poem you say, oh yeah, I think I know what they're talking about. You know, the poem gives you a concept in sometimes beautiful language, sometimes harsh language, sometimes in everyday language. But see, I'm going on and on. I'm nerding out about literature. I could do that for the rest of this conversation. I love it. And that's what makes one thing that makes these books stand out. Now, some of you, in fact, probably all of you, have talked in some ways about the content of the what's in Homegirls. Finding explanations for one's own life as a Black woman or a Black femme that you couldn't find anywhere else. And when these, when the Homegirls came out in particular, but also The Truth That Never Hurts in some ways, when these books came out, there were not necessarily counterpart books. You know, there weren't a lot of other books that were like them. I have right here, and I'm sure I'm going to hold it up in the wrong way. I don't know what it looks like on the screen, but I hope you see something. This is Conditions 5, the Black Women's Issue that I co-edited in 1979 with Lorraine Bethel. It was a literary magazine, a lesbian, feminist, leftist literary magazine called Conditions. And they asked me to co-edit a Black Women's Issue after I'd written an essay for them called Toward a Black Feminist Criticism. Toward a Black Feminist Criticism was the first essay, article, whatever you want to call it, that asserted that there was a Black women's literary tradition. It's the first article that ever did that. And it also, because, you know, I was newly out, you know, in the mid-1970s, I came out. I wanted to write about lesbian literature, specifically Black lesbian literature, but there wasn't any that I could find. And so I just decided, okay, I'll just snag a book called Sula by Toni Morrison, and I'll write about it as if it's a lesbian novel. Ooh, okay. So be that as it may, that was in Toward a Black Feminist Criticism. I got asked to do Conditions 5, what became Conditions 5, the Black Women's Issue. But at a certain point, because it was a periodical, a magazine, it was going to go out of print. And so that's why I decided I was going to take work from Conditions 5 and turn it into a book. And that book is Homegirls. And they are not identical. There's work in Homegirls that is not in Conditions 5, and there's work in Conditions 5 that's not in Homegirls. If you look up Conditions 5 online to try to buy a copy, they are now valued at hundreds of dollars because they're so rare, and people still seem to want them. But I just wanted to get into that thing of why something is a classic. Loving the word, and I got to be around some of the best people of the word in my lifetime. I'm thinking specifically about Audre Lorde. I'm thinking about Alice Walker. I'm thinking about June Jordan. I'm thinking about Sonia Sanchez, who's still with us. I'm thinking about Toni Cade Bambara. I knew these people. And, you know, when you know people like that, you know, you have to step up your game, right? You know, we created something really incredible. At the same time that I was involved in building Black feminism, I was involved in building Black women's studies. The fact that we're sitting here with each other tonight around and with people all around the country that we can't see. You can see us, thank goodness. But we're talking about things that happened decades ago and that still have value. But a part of the value is the what's in the book content-wise, the messaging, how new it was, how groundbreaking, what people were saying about lives that until then were invisible and that were also often generally despised. And then also that thing of like, what were my standards around what was going to be in the anthologies? Everything in The Truth That Never Hurts is my own writing. And not all of my writing that I had done up until that point made the cut. There's a lot of stuff that I had published that did not get into The Truth That Never Hurts because for the book, it was not up to my standards. Think about that. My own writing. I bet there are writers out here with us today.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Care, The Highest Stage of Capitalism, by Premila Nadasen. In this eye-opening reckoning with the care economy, scholar Premila Nadasen traces its logic and history from its roots in racial capitalism and slavery to its exponential growth as a site of profit and extraction. Today's care economy, she shows, is an institutionalized, hierarchical system in which some people's pain translates into other people's profit. As Sarah Jaffe puts it, in clear and concise prose, Nadasen takes apart the care industrial complex that has emerged, like the military and prison industrial complexes before it, to wring the last drops of profit from the lives and deaths of working people. An absolutely necessary intervention in the most important political debate of our times. Find Care, The Highest Stage of Capitalism at haymarketbooks.org.
So let's switch gears now and talk about some Black feminist politics. Does anybody want to jump in and like raise a Black feminist political question?
Sure. I also want to say, if folks can still hear me, what I love about Homegirls and across all your writing, Ms. Barbara, is that family is at the core of all that you discuss and how that has shaped your Black feminist politic. And so I just wanted to offer that because I feel like many of us can go back into our lives and look at our siblings, our parents and our grandmothers and other mothers and our biological and chosen kin and say this is how they also inspired my Black feminist politic, even though they may have not identified as a Black feminist.
Right, indeed.
I'll say that.
Right. But and that's exactly what I was...
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Ms. Barbara.
I was saying that was exactly when you read that whole section that I was reading excerpts of, that's exactly the point I was making, that my Black feminism comes naturally and legitimately from the values and the things I saw around the women who raised me. And so many of us say the same thing.
Yes, thank you. And now we're going to hop into some juicy Black feminist politics. Does anyone want to start off? Because I don't want to keep talking, but I want us to, like Ms. Barbara said, get into it.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I think is striking in all of the work that I've read by Ian Barbara, I'm very excited to read this forthcoming biography and many other things. But the fact is, this is not just like a literary field. This is not just an abstract question. This is about empowering people for the purposes of organizing and fighting for liberation. And I think, that's at least the thing that I've always gotten from this. And I think that that's important because, again, one of the areas this tends to survive in or that people may first encounter Black feminism is in the academy, which is not always at all connected to sort of the reasons why a Black feminist analysis is important in the first place, which is its original intent is to actually change things for people, to actually understand our situation for that function. And so I just wanted to raise that and, kind of a question to everybody. I guess it's not so much a concrete question as it is sort of to talk about that connection between, a Black feminist lens or analysis or, sort of compilation of work, whether it's art and literature or whether it is in the context of understanding history as it actually has happened, which is a whole other thing, and the organizing that we're actually trying to do on the ground.
Tamika, did you have anything to share? Because you're a world-class organizer.
Oh.
So I bet you have something.
That is high praise. I appreciate it. I mean, I think, you know, we talk about lenses often inside of the organizing work. And I think, you know, a lens is really... is really only important in so much as it impacts the thing that you're looking at, right? And so if we are, I think the development of Black feminist understanding feels important, right? The generation of a Black feminist knowledge is important. And it is only important in as much as we can use that to say, these are our current conditions. This is actually where we want to be, where Black women want to be, ought to be, where Black communities want to be and ought to be, and this is how we get from A to B. And so I think that is for me the importance of a Black feminist lens, is that without a Black feminist lens, we miss things in our understanding and in our development of our strategy, right? We miss nuance, we miss understandings of the condition that get us from where we are right now to where we want to be, to our vision of the world we want. And so I think, you know, I was thinking as, you know, as you were talking earlier, and Jamie, you're talking about the inclusion of family really in so much of the work. And the thing that really rises to the top for me that is included inside of so much of the work, not only in Homegirls itself, but also in like the longer thread of Black feminist literature and Black feminist writing is as a Black feminist spiritualist is spirit and spirituality, right? And so I think there are so many times and ways in which we understand or we're grappling with the conditions on the ground in our communities without understanding a spiritual context, without understanding trauma, without understanding, you know, the role of spirit in resistance and resilience. And so Black feminism makes sure that we hold that understanding together, right? So that's just something I'm thinking about in terms of like the kinds of things we miss in building our strategies when we do not have a Black feminist lens and Black feminist understanding. And so I think there is a space where there's like Black feminist theorizing. And it's great and it's beautiful and it's lofty and also is disconnected from what folks are experiencing in reality. And I don't think you can have a Black feminist understanding without being in relationship to and in community with folks in Black communities, in Black, you know, Black women, and not just the Black women in ivory towers, but the Black women, you know, the domestic workers, the Black women who are, you know, who are in the gig economy, the Black women who are, you know, single mamas. And we have to be able to be in relationship with and in conversation with Black women of all stripes to really have a full understanding, a full Black feminist understanding. And so divorcing, so much of that comes from the feedback between the theory and the organizing, the academic and the practice, what the kind of ivory tower in the grassroots. And so without that sort of feedback loop, then we've lost something. We've lost something in our strategies. We lost something in the way we think about organizing. And so I think one of the things that has been so much fun for me as an organizer had been introducing Black feminism to domestic workers, to Black domestic workers, and in particular, Black domestic workers in the South, having them have conversations. I used to work at National Domestic Workers Alliance. I used to run the Black organizing program there, and we would organize house cleaners, home care workers, nannies, and you know, we would come together. We had our Black Organizing Institute once a year. All the Black domestic workers from across, you know, there were our members across the country, bring them together. And they would, you know, talk about the conditions on their jobs. We're also like, let's talk about what it means to be Black and woman and poor and, you know, all these things. Let's talk about intersectionality. Let's talk about, you know, let's actually, here is the Combahee River Collective statement. And all of these folks who are like, yo, I did not know that people have put the things that I was dealing with to paper. Like, this is amazing. And so like that, like seeing that sort of, seeing folks who in their everyday lives are not interacting with the text in the same way, being able to see them grapple with the text and overlay it over their own experiences. And then also see how it helps them understand why their experiences are the way they are and help them build strategy to change their experiences is such a profound, life-changing kind of part of the organizing work. And I think that is the space that we have to remember to be in, is that for every, you know, text, there is a person on the ground who needs to have access to that, who needs to be informing that, but who also needs to be seen inside of it, who needs to be able to see themselves inside of it.
Well, listen, I just like, go ahead, Tamika, because you just said it. And what you said reminds me of Asada Shakur when she, like, I'm paraphrasing, but when she was like, I just couldn't have my head in, like, in the libraries. I had to be out in the streets. Right. And I think as someone in academia, I see the ways in which the Academy, the Ivory Tower, has pacified and co-opted and de-radicalized what Black feminists, a radical leftist Black feminist politic is, because people are trying to get tenure and people are trying to get these things, but only talking about the theory, right? For example, so many people can cite Toni Morrison and bell hooks and Barbara Smith and June Jordan, but when it talks about the conversation on Palestine, they are silent, right? Because they don't want to put it to praxis. They want to just to theorize and get tenure and get the big bucks from it, but they're not talking about working class, poor, sex workers, domestics, right? They're not talking about these things. And I also think about the inception of like feminist politics, or thinking about feminist consciousness raising groups, right? Where that started off with working class and poor women leading these discussions. And then we have the institutionalization of women's studies, and then we have Black women's studies, which I think is so important. But then I feel like what I'm seeing now in academia consistently is a hoarding of resources, right? I think about JSTOR even, like many of these articles written by Ms. Barbara, right, are on JSTOR. She's talking about Black feminist criticism. She's talking about bell hooks and things of that nature, but only academics who have the institutional access can access this literature. And so my question is, as a Black feminist academic, whatever that is, because I don't even know anymore, child, what are we doing, right? What are we doing when we're in these positions of privilege, because it's a privilege, to ensure that we're not hoarding resources, that we're not extracting from working class and poor Black women and gender expansive people and interviewing them and putting them in our dissertation and never going back to the communities anymore? What are we doing when we see critical race theory, intersectionality, identity politics being attacked by right-wing conservatives? What are we doing about the Palestinian question? What are we doing about all these things? And I feel like many of us have grown complacent and not have connected, or not connecting the theory and the praxis. It's just a theory, and we get to go back or to our homes while sadly children and many other people are being murdered or bombed or things like that. So my question and my provocation is like, where do we go from here with the Black feminist politics? So let me be quiet, because Tamika got me on a roll. I feel like I'm a preaching.
Well, I was ready to roll too. All of you though are really, you know, dropping science over here. And it's really gratifying to see the level of excitement that people have about ideas, but also about sharing and bringing ideas to the roots of where those ideas sprang from to begin with, which is to our communities, our working communities, our working class communities, our working poor communities, our incarcerated communities, sex workers, all the things that people have talked about. And guess what? That was always the intention. That was always the intention. I would tell people, I've told them often, that my goal for myself as a writer is to be understandable to anyone who it can read. Now, depending on who I'm writing for and what I'm writing about, I can use different kind of tone, different kind of vocabulary, language. You know, like there's a difference between writing something that has no footnotes or citations and then one that has a lot, you know. And when you look at my work, you will see that there is that variation. Earlier in my life, when I was still involved in graduate work and planning to teach full time, you know, in the future, there's nothing wrong with having citations and receipts. You know, there's nothing wrong with that at all. But the thing is that I always wanted the work to land where you all are talking about at landing. And It's one of the things that, you know, I think it was Haley, what Haley was talking about. Haley was basically talking about class consciousness, I think. And that I've always operated, tried to operate with class consciousness, because after all, I am a socialist and an anti-capitalist. So that should happen. You know, that needs to happen. But I have so many thoughts. I'm stumbling over them in my mind. But the major thing I'm trying to talk about, are trying to reinforce from what all of you have said, is that Black feminism is for everyone, and it's not for people of a particular gender. You know, it's not even for people of a particular race, ethnicity, or nationality. Because to me, the truth is the truth, you know. So there's no reason why anyone can't look at this stuff if they're not defensive, if they're not like closed down, if they're not like full of false consciousness and bad ideas and bad attitudes. There's no reason that one cannot read Black feminist writing of any variety, whether it's creative poetry, drama, you know, songs, or political analysis, which is a lot of what I do, you know, the latter, political analysis. There's no reason it cannot apply to you. Because as far as I'm concerned, as I said, the truth is the truth. The name of the book is The Truth That Never Hurts. And don't ask me to explain that, you know, don't ask me to explain it. It's something I heard growing up, and I don't think I've ever properly explained what it is, except to say that, like, it's an extreme example. Like, for example, here's an example. Like, it seems in the current times, in the early 20th century, one of the things that we've learned is that having multiple criminal indictments against you is a qualification to serve in the highest office in the land. In other words, being an indicted person under the surveillance of the judicial system is a career, you know, and it's a job qualification. And if you said that to somebody, and we're thinking about a certain person who will remain nameless, the response to that could be, well, that's a truth that never hurts. It's true, you know, and there's like a little sting, you know, a little twist to it. I want to talk about, I just want to say one thing, that thing about class consciousness and socialist analysis and socialist commitments, socialist understanding, you know, understandings of the world, our social worlds, and our political economies, racial capitalism, heteropatriarchy, etc. I always say that the reason that the Combahee River Collective statement in particular, not these books as whole entities, but the reason that the Combahee River Collective statement, which is considered to be a defining document of Black feminism, the reason that it has lasted over the years is because it is from a socialist perspective. There's a class and economic perspective in it. It's not about like, isn't it nice that Black women are these kind of people, and like that we're all here together, and you know, the outer stuff, you know, like because we have style, we have culture, we have talent, etc. It's not enough. You know, that's not enough. We need to dig deep. What in the world is going on here that Black women and other women of color, and then women across the board, make less on the dollar than people who are defined as male at birth and live as, as male in a patriarchal world? What's going on here? How do we explain that? Is it that some people are more talented than others if they have certain organs? And that, you know, and other people are less talented because they have other sets of organs? No, I don't think that's what it's about. It's that these are systematic issues. And as I said, we have to dig deep around that. And also there's the intersectional aspect, that we're looking at all the systems of oppression simultaneously. We're not just looking at one vector or two or three or four or even four, five, six. You know, we didn't write that much about disability and ableism at that time. We were not writing about transphobia and oppression against people who are trans and gender nonconforming. There are all kinds of systems and all kinds of ways to understand the world that we live in, but we also understand, at least some of us do, that the economic driver of capitalism on the globe and in our nation, but in many other places as well, has certain almost predictable results. So it's not about Black feminism so that you can get into the C-suite or the corner office. We're not talking about representational politics here. We're talking about liberation. We're talking about freedom. And those are not necessarily messages and things that most people want to deal with, because there's a lot of like, well, if I only did this, if I only made this amount of money, if I only got hired here, if this set of people recognized me. No, it's really not about that. It's about something much deeper. I see Black feminist politics and Black feminism. I see it as, the movement that can save our lives. And that, as we say in the Combahee River Collective statement, that if Black women were free, it would mean that everybody else had to be, because we would be dealing with all the systems of oppression. What has happened to identity politics has been very distorted. What we meant, and this is for the record, when we wrote about identity politics, is that we thought that we had a right as Black women to formulate our own political agendas based upon the experiences that our identities brought to the fore. That's all. That's it. That's all. We weren't saying we were superior to anyone. We were not saying that other people were inferior to us. We were not saying that we would never work with anyone and be in political struggle with anyone who was different from ourselves. We weren't saying any of those things, but we were saying that it was about time that people who were simultaneously of African heritage, because that usually is what it means to be Black, being of African heritage, people who were identified by gender as women, people who did not have economic privilege by and large, and people, in many cases, people who were involved in the Black feminist movement at that time, people who were not heterosexual and therefore oppressed because of their sexuality, that we actually had a right to say, you know what a priority for us would be? Deal with sterilization abuse. Because those affected disproportionately Black women and women of color. So that's what it meant. And it's been taken all the way around the block and met itself, you know, and just nothing but confusion. Well, I think we could go on with this, but I would like us to get some other things that concern us. And I'd like to hear what people want to make sure to bring out before we begin to hear from people who are participating, but not on the panel, because we are going to have Q&A in about 10 or so minutes. What we might want to make sure that people understand about these politics, this work.
Yeah, I wanted us to keep talking about, if y'all don't mind, representational politics, because I just was teaching in my class and my students had never heard about Anita Hill. And 32 years ago was the Anita Hill hearing. And we're thinking about, obviously, like Clarence Thomas and like this, you know, skin representational politics, right? And even though, like, fast forward 32 years later, we have a lot more Black elected officials. We have a lot more Black women elected officials. Sadly, I've seen many scholars, you know, equate Black feminist politics to many of these elected officials, and there, and that is not a Black feminist politics. I'm not going to get into naming names, but I love naming names. So anyway, we're not getting into that. I really wanted us to talk.
Oh, name some names then. Just name them.
I mean, I've seen.
You can refer to who they are without saying their names. You can describe their positions, perhaps.
I mean, I'm seeing scholarship that it says that, you know, Vice President Kamala Harris is a Black feminist, right? And so what do we mean by these terms, and how do we address like this when we talk about representational politics? I'm really interested in everyone's perspective because there is such a distortion.
Yeah, that's extremely important, and I appreciate you bringing that up because, you know, well, just by way of direct anecdote. I mean, I live in New York under Mayor Cop Eric Adams. who is kind of like a great microcosm of all the problems with seeing representational politics as any kind of avenue to Black liberation, if we're even talking about liberation, because I think that that's actually a question when people see that as the goal. Because if we're talking about a person who, not just as an individual, but in his role as mayor, is in a position where he's the head of the fifth largest army in the world. I forget what the NYPD is now, but the amount of cops that we have in this city at the disposal of that mayor, whose relationship to them is basically to oppress migrants, to target and scapegoat homeless people and mentally ill people, to siphon off resources in the name of a law and order agenda, that only benefits rich people in this city, which is already the wealthiest city in the world, which already has one of the biggest housing crises in the country. All of that ends up, instead of going into resources that might actually help people to stay afloat, into more policing. And so, I mean, it doesn't matter who's at the helm of that, is what that shows. It doesn't matter that a Black person is in that position. It doesn't, you know, mean that he's just like confused. That is the role in that position. And so it doesn't matter whether or not that person is Black or not. It's actually a systemic question that we have to tackle as such. And so if we're talking about where power lies and how people get free, we actually have to have an understanding that there's a class difference in terms of the interests of a lot of these people who are in positions of power, and the vast, vast majority of working class Black people, that actually we have a lot more in common as working class people than we do with a person who happens to share our skin color and is in a position of power, because the systems are still racist, regardless of who is running them. I also, this is a little bit shifting gears, but, Barbara, I've really appreciated your saying not only kind of what you meant by identity politics, and that it was not meant to be this exclusionary thing, but was actually meant to be an expansive thing that would include everybody in the fight for liberation and would see that as something in everyone's interest. I think that's very important because, one of the big debates, debates eternal, but again, especially now on the left, is about whether or not we can focus on so-called class-based or universal demands and counterposing that to demands that are focused on the most oppressed. And I think that that's a very problematic way to approach any kind of real grappling with the best way that the ruling class has had to divide workers since this country was founded, which was anti-Black racism. It's sort of like leaving that totally untouched. And so I feel like this, one of the things that you offer is actually saying, like, this is actually a stronger basis for unity and a better basis for unity to have people see their interest in fighting oppression on a broad basis and for oppressed people themselves to lead that fight than it is to simply kind of wish people to suddenly only see their class as the primary thing, when that's just not the reality that we live in or the way that class is constituted, especially in this country.
That's right. So much insight about the meaning of what these politics are. It's like, wow, great. I'm so glad that you get to explain what it seems that that some of us have been involved in prior, to this particular historical period. That perspective, that if you take into account the various realities of humans' lives as they interact with economic and social systems, that somehow that's less legitimate than pretending that those factors don't exist, is like how one is better than the other. So I lived in a neighborhood for 34 years that is one of the poorest neighborhoods in Albany. And I found out things like, for example, what's it like to have to use public transportation to get everywhere? And just like what your day is like, what is your day like when you have like more than, like, even if you have one child that needs to go to school in the opposite side of the place where you're off, where you're working, do you see what I'm saying? In other words, how does public transportation affect the lives of people who have several young people that they have to get to various places and then have to go in another direction, another geographic direction to get to their place of work, which is what maintains the family. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like people don't even think about what it's like to have to negotiate on a regular daily basis. You're like living in the neighborhood, and I've been very involved in our public school system in Albany, and realizing and finding out about what happens in the summertime when school meals are no longer available. And like, where are the, the food vans, that have been organized, usually with not sufficient funding, where are they going to be parked in my neighborhood so that people can get to them? Will they be parked too far away for some people in the neighborhood to walk to get the food? I mean, just the basic kinds of things. The fact that as far as like around healthcare, the fact that the infant and particularly, well, both infant and maternal mortality rates for Black women are astronomical in comparison to white women in particular, more parallel to Indigenous women. And then depending, because we have numbers of different kinds of groups of people of color in this country. But why is it in a country that's supposed to be one of the richest countries in the world with one of the most advanced medical systems as far as research and, breakthroughs and what have you? But no universal health care. God forbid we have that. But the thing is, why is it in a country that is not operating and under conditions that we would associate with the global South, why do we have statistics around maternal and infant mortality that mirror the statistics in the global South? There are neighborhoods in Albany, New York, northern city, state capital. There are neighborhoods where the infant and maternal mortality rates are similar to, if not worse, than in the global South. What could that be about? Do we need to think about that for a while? No, not really, because what we're talking about is racism, white supremacy, and racial capitalism as it intersects with gender. Because who is, in the reproductive, who is involved in social reproduction as well as other, the more conventional types of reproduction? It is people defined as women at birth. And then there are people, of course, all kinds of people have children and can raise children and nurture children and bring children to where children need to be. You don't have to reproduce to have a family or to take care of kids. And what does it mean then that you're trans or you're gay or you're lesbian and you are raising children? What happens to you in a society that is transphobic and homophobic and also misogynist and sexist? What happens? These are all questions, that when you have that intersectional perspective, you can actually delve into. And I've had some interesting experiences this year, like really kind of being in a debate. I did this with Robin D.G. Kelly, and we were talking to a certain individual whose name is Norman Finkelstein. And he had written, he's written a book that came out, I think this year, if not late last year, but he's written a book where he basically says everything about identity politics and all the things that we think are ways of understanding the world more deeply. Just as you said, Haley, he says that it's all baloney. It's like, okay, whatever. And I know I've seen Norman speaking out about the situation in Palestine and Israel. It's not, I don't do like condemnations across the board, but it's just like, hear us, hear what we're trying to share with you. You don't know everything because you live in a certain kind of gender, race, class bubble. There are other experiences out there. We want to bring those to the fore. I think we have, I'm seeing questions in our chat that we're going to look at surreptitiously.
I want to jump in real quick on the representation.
Sure. Oh yeah, sure.
On the representation politics. First of all, you talked about Jamie. You mentioned Clarence Thomas, and I always joke. I'm like, as you know, as a member of the Gullah Geechee community, we apologize for Clarence Thomas. We apologize, but also. You know, like you were saying, Haley, I live in Atlanta. I live in the metro Atlanta area. And, you know, Atlanta is one of those places where we can see so clearly, especially in this current moment, not only the ways in which identity as Blackness is not a guarantee of an impetus towards liberation or liberatory praxis, but also an identity as a progressive is not necessarily an indication of how folks will act when they get into office. Because, our honorable mayor, Andre Dickens, had very much campaigned as a progressive, very much build himself as a progressive. I was talking to my kid just wrote an article about Cop City, and I was talking to him about, you know, being at rallies with Andre Dickens when he was a city council person for Fight for 15 kinds of things, you know, and when he got the opportunity to get into higher office, he aligned himself differently. He aligned himself with the wealthy white folks in Buckhead. And he did what was necessary for him to get into position in office. So much going even so far as to undercut his own legislation when he was a progressive council person. So even, you know, the thing about politics is that it doesn't stop at election. And I think, you know, we have to remember that part of it. The organizing doesn't stop when a person gets into office. We have to be holding folks accountable always, but also that if folks are not accountable to you, it doesn't matter what their identity is. It doesn't matter how they identify. It matters who they are accountable to. And so at the end of the day, when Andre Dickens or when we had Keisha Lance Bottoms or whatever, you know, Mayor Kasime Reed, we can go down the list of Black mayors in Atlanta who are very unaccountable to the Black communities who elected them. And as much as, you know, you go around Atlanta and people will say, my mayor named Keisha, I got a mayor named Andre. And I'm like, that's cute. And he does not care about your life. And so I think we have to be really clear about that. As we're thinking about, you know, representation. And there's a quote, Barbara, that you said, I don't remember where you said it, but we use it all the time at Women's March. We're like, well, you know what Barbara says, they took the identity and left the politics on the floor. And so, we quote it all the time in the team. So I just wanted to say that before we jump to the Q&A.
And Jamie, did you have anything you wanted to share before we look at some of the questions?
I just love that they took the identity and left the politics.
They did because people are fascinated, you know, by their individual experiences, and they should be. You know, it's fascinating to be me. It's fascinating to be you. But do I build a politic based upon growing up in Cleveland, you know, as a twin, you know, on East 132nd Street? Yeah, like, is that what I base my politics on? Or do I base my politics on values? That's how you build movements. And that's how you win. Because we can't win in enclaves. We cannot win in enclaves. We win when there's mass mobilizing of people who are done, who are very, very done and very, very tired of the status quo as it exists, who know that they deserve rights, a decent quality of life, work that is not onerous and oppressive and exploited, real pay for real work, equal pay for actual work, who realize that the wealth of nations is based upon the workers, not those who own the means of production. You know, where you go to that job, what if nobody went to where that job was? That factory with whatever was in it would be worth nothing because nothing would be able to be produced. So the only way, though, as I said, we get enough people mobilized, we have to be able to work across differences. So it's like the politics of people that makes me understand who is a co-conspirator and ally and who is not. Those people that you are talking about, because, of course, all of us have our, you know, list of them, depending on where we live geographically. But the thing is, those people who you're talking about, Tamika, we have seen all that before. They are not on our side. They are absolutely not on our side. They're not on the side of the people. And one of the things, here's a perfect example. When Queen Elizabeth whatever fell off the mortal coil. That's a literary way of saying that she died. When she was no longer with us, you know, on this particular planet and plane, it was incredible. Do you remember what happened on Twitter, on social media, probably other platforms? But Twitter is where people get the good remarks, you know, where they may say the things that are so funny. It's just like you're just dying, you know, because it's like, how did anybody think to say that so fast, you know? But what was happening when Queen Elizabeth died is that people of color around the world, from the many different places that have been colonized by the so-called British crown. Black people, of course, but then who pops up? The Irish. And the Irish, like, I mean, they were like going to town on her behind. They were going to town on the royal families behind. And like one of the things that we read during that period is like Black people were saying, let them have it. You know, they're going to win this fight. Like who has the most to say in the most clever and innovative way about this den of thieves called the British royal family. Just let them have it, because as they pointed out, they've been doing it for longer than we have. And the thing is, like, the solidarity across social media between Irish people, you know, and Black people in different various places and people of color, it was just beautiful to see. It was beautiful to see. And see, that's what solidarity looks like. I have four questions that we're not going to answer, but these are four questions that I have been thinking about and formulating. They would be good for another discussion. And that moves us into a discussion. We'll go to at least one question, hopefully more in the chat. But these are questions about how do we formulate our politics? How do we figure out what's what? And these are the questions. What do we mean by struggle? What do we mean by struggle? What do we mean by solidarity? That's one of the most important concepts, and it's really important now with the situation that is going on in Israel, Palestine, and surrounding countries who may very well get into all this. You know, a friend of mine who is very politically astute and also Irish American, by the way, he was texting me today, and he was saying that he was concerned about this being the beginning of World War III. And I said, yeah, I've been feeling the same thing. So the first two questions, what do we mean by struggle? What do we mean by solidarity? What do we mean by radical? And what do we mean by revolutionary? Many people think that radical means that you're a nonconformist, that you have, like the Zoom I was just on before this one of a local group that I'm in love with, called the Albany Justice Coalition. There was an individual who had changed their hair color. Their hair is now blue, like kind of like, you know, bluebird blue, you know? Well, I don't think you have blue hair, so it doesn't make a difference what kind of blue it was. It was blue. And the thing is that, so was that a radical thing to do? I don't know. I think it might've been a fashionable thing to do. It was fun. But the thing is that if people think that being a radical is like how many piercings you have, what kinds of things that you wear, whether you eat certain things and don't eat certain things, lifestyle stuff. Lifestyle stuff. Radical means going to the root. You know, if you ever took botany or even biology where they talked about plant life, the root system, the main root, I think it's called, there is something called a radical as far as the root system is concerned. And the thing is that that's what it means to be a radical. You go to the root. You don't deal with the cosmetic aspects of like, why is life so messed up in the United States or wherever else? You look at what's the root causes. So that's my little sermonette for today. Do we have questions?
We do.
Yeah. Would folks mind if I get to that last one? I think there's other people who are probably more equipped for some of the rest, but I like this last one from Katie Madison.
Okay.
So I'm just reading the last part. You've all touched on the issue of the weaponization of clickbait language in a society that seems to reward those who use the language of Black feminism. Can you each speak briefly to how you navigate this? Yeah, it's interesting, right? Everybody from, you know, Hillary Clinton to whoever on down knows the term intersectionality today, which is like exciting in an you know, in the sense that sometimes when that happens, it means that there's something that people in power feel they have to respond to. In other words, if people have to shift their language to sound more radical, then obviously they know that more people have some sense that something is wrong in society. But obviously that's not enough. That is cosmetic. It isn't actually about changing anything. I actually appreciated something that you said, Barbara, because I guess I'm just quoting you all day, but you said this in a conversation we had before this meeting, that a narrative is not the same thing as a strategy. And I think that that's really important, because the point is not just to use the terms or to talk in a radical sounding way or to reference radical aspirations, but to actually say, okay, based on this understanding, what is it going to take for us to get from A to B? What is it going to take for us to actually get from the kind of society that we have that is so oppressive, that does divide us in so many ways, to the kind of society that we actually want to see, one where people's labor is actually valued, where people, where the value of the labor that we put in doesn't just go to support a very small minority who require oppression on the rest of us to maintain that. And so I think that talking, you know, about these things can't just be an abstract exercise. Like, one thing I love about TikTok and really Gen Z in general is kind of, there's sort of a default socialism that a lot of younger people seem to be gravitating toward. And that gives me a lot of hope, because it's just kind of like completely a default to say that capitalism sucks. You know what I mean? That seems to be much more common sense to a lot of people. And that is an experience in the world we live in. But when people just say that online and they're not organizing and they're not meeting people in the real world and they're not in community and trying to figure out, you know, what has worked and what hasn't and what changes things, then that's where you get into that abstraction that I think is less helpful and is much more in some ways about radical posturing than it is about radical change. And so the more we can be in spaces where these politics come alive, where we're testing our theory in practice, the more that that grounds our actual understanding and what, you know, what is meaningful in this life, in this world.
I love that. And like, that goes along into like another question I see that I want to kind of chop in, because it's like, how are we testing our theory as it relates to our praxis? And someone asked, my question would be, what are some things the younger generation of Black feminists can do to continue education around thought/frameworks and stay hopeful? And I think one thing I'm vested in as like, I'm not like, I'm a millennial, so I'm like telling of my little age now, I'm like, but is that I'm very interested and Black feminist politics that are not necessarily tethered to the ivory tower. So how are younger Black folks organizing Black feminist consciousness raising groups in forms of book clubs, in forms of free political education that is not necessarily rooted at the university? I am really vested in a Black feminist politics as Maroonage, as a Quilombo, as Palenque, going back to like once again, those feminist consciousness raising questions and community building that did not necessarily thrive off the institutionalization of academia. For example, my grandmother is 80 years old. She is my first Black feminist to me. She did not finish her college degree, but she still is just as much of a scholar to me than any of these other scholars that I am around. And so how do we get back to that, where working class, working poor students, right, or younger folks, I should say, can start creating their own spaces that doesn't necessarily have to thrive on someone with a PhD, because we don't need PhDs to do this work. We don't need degrees to be archivists. We don't need degrees to be organizers. And so that's where I would say, like, free political education, going to a library, starting a book club on your own. You don't need the permission to do it. You can just do it. So that would be my offering.
And
sorry.
Oh, sorry.
No, you go on.
I was going to say, to add in there, to the kind of collective study, popular education. I come out of the Black, you know, Black organizing tradition in the South, and popular education is such a big part of what we do and how we do our work and how we build community, how we build strategy, how we build knowledge. But also I get the great pleasure of being a part of an organization called BOLD, Black Organizing for Leadership and Dignity. And one of the things that we do is we're, you know, building political education with Black leaders, Black left leaders, is collective reading. And so a lot of our folks who are leaders in organizations, you know, and they're doing phenomenal work, but they do not have degrees, or they are not well versed in reading academic texts. And so reading together, not just like I take the book home, we all read a chapter and we come back, but actually sitting together and reading together so that we can be in the same place, make sure we have the same understanding of the text, so that we are all actually collectively building our understanding together. It's such a, has been such a transformational offering to so many of the leaders that we work with inside of BOLD. It's just like, you can actually sit together and let's read this thing aloud. And wait, go back. They said this thing, I got lost in it. What does that mean? What is this concept? What is that word? What is this whole paragraph is a lot for me. And breaking it down together and being in space together not only builds literacy, it builds understanding, it builds collective knowledge, but it also builds relationship to each other as we build out, you know, as we are in community with each other in order to do this work better.
Yeah, I just wanted to say something because I know our time is it has gone very quickly. And soon we'll come to a temporary end because, you know, we're with you. You know, we're with each other, even if we're not in this particular time slot and space. And again, thank you so much to Haymarket and to Rutgers and to everyone who came and who's with us today to make this possible. But like, what I want to talk about is, you know, you are talking, or some of you have been talking about, how do we do study? How do we like develop, you know, ideas and analysis? I'm interested in like looking at problems that exist in communities and figuring out how to address them. I'm thinking about Black Mamas Bailout. To me, that is perfect Black feminist organizing. It's perfect. And not because I know the ins and outs and the day to day, although I do know people who are involved in it, but the reason it's so good and is so Black feminist is that it's looking at the objective situation, a problem that Black women share, which is over incarceration, which is, you know, mass incarceration. And like many people in our country, they stay in cages, they stay incarcerated because they don't have the money to get out. So there are all kinds of criminals running around the landscape. Another, you know, like, again, another reference to that prior president of the United States. He's been 1 minute in jail. Again, he's a big criminal, you know, but the thing is, he has the money and the crooked lawyers or the whatever kind of lawyers he has. And, you know, he has a whole crew of people who get to stay out of jail by and large. But like for just regular working people, like one ticket, you know, one, you know, traffic infraction, one this, one that, land you inside. And as people point out, you know, you're in there because you don't have $100 to get out. And what does that do then to families and communities? Most women who are incarcerated have children and family members, but particularly dependent children who are depending on them. So what does doing the Black Mamas Bailout accomplish? It gets people out and back in their community. And in that process, I don't know what kinds of things that people talk about who are involved. That is, those who are finding the bail money, identifying people to get out, being outside the jail to welcome, because I know there's a whole welcoming process for that. I don't know if they continue to have connections past the day that they get out. I suspect that they do, because if they're doing serious Black feminist work, they're not just going to leave you out there hanging by yourself after you come out. But the thing is, that's a practical problem that people thought, what's the solution? The state's not going to do a thing for us in that regard. I donate to Black Mamas Bailout, you know, because it's like, why wouldn't I do that? One other example of that grassroots organizing is like in Boston during the Combahee River days, when we were working on sterilization abuse and also reproductive justice around the Hyde Amendment and the beginning to take away reproductive rights and access, we had what we called Third World Women's Health Nights. And we talked about every aspect of health that people wanted to talk about: nutrition, lack of quality health care, lack of insurance, other kind of illnesses and situations that had nothing to do with the reproductive, you know, our reproductive capacity. But we would have them in a community school in the Boston area, in the South End, before it was gentrified up to the eyeballs. And we would talk about what the people who came wanted to talk about. And out of that solidarity that we built, when they murdered, when somebody murdered, and it was a group of somebody's murdered 12 Black women in a four-month period in 1979, some of the people who we had met in the context of just talking about health and our bodies and our rights, we were there together. We were like interlocked because we were working on real issues. You know, we weren't talking about fancy ideas. Some of us were reading books. Some of us were writing books. All of us were in the street.
Oh, what a way to end, Miss Barbara. Yes, Miss Barbara. What a way to end this event. Oh my gosh. Give it up, Miss Barbara. Woo.
I know, right? Absolutely.
I'm looking at a little clock, so I think we just about nailed it as far as
right on.
I wish we could answer all of your questions. I always do. That is questions from people in the audience. But thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, Miss Tamika Middleton.
Thank you.
I'm spelling with an X. I can't say MX. I don't know how you say that. Okay. But thank you, Haley Pezzett. Thank you, Jamie Swift.
Thank you, Miss Barbara Smith, the Barbara Smith, the best of the best. Thank you.
Yeah. Find the books, please. There's a new preface. There's a new preface to Homegirls. More thoughts on Black feminism.
Thank y'all.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.